Well, this is the last Sunday of this month where I'll be able to hopefully going to finish up some things we've been talking about here about the new social order. And I know I've been down about 800 rabbit trails, maybe 1,000 rabbit trails. We're going to try to stay on the main road today, hopefully. And just kind of by way of review, some things that we've been discussing here about how progressivism, we spent some time talking about that, and then how the education system in our country really began to change and shift back really in, you know, the 20s and 30s, but no one really noticed it. And no one noticed it because they did it secretly. They did it by going into the textbooks, as we brought that out last time. And the man we've been talking about is a man named George Counts, this little book that he wrote way back in 1933, Dare the School Build a New Social Order. And it was very important for us to understand last time, and I started back with this statement from his book, to understand, again, we talked about this, about the definition of democracy. And again, how people think today that America is a democracy, and you hear that all the time, and we're actually a republic. I'm not going to go back over that again. It makes me too upset. But it's one of those little pet peeves, and I keep driving home to the kids at school. We are not a democracy. I mean, you can be democratic or understand freedom and those kind of things, but we're not a democracy, we're a republic. And so we vote people that we have laws that are established, and we vote for people to enforce and to write and to implement those laws. But again, here is where the definition of democracy began to change. And instead of it being, as right here, the most genuine expression of democracy has little to do with our political institutions, but it is a sentiment with respect to the moral equality of men. When you hear people today talking about democracy, they're not really talking. They may think, or they may, actually, they don't even probably know what they're talking about. But in deep down, it's the idea of we want to be equal with everybody. Everybody has got to be equal no matter what. No matter what you have to do, no matter the cost, no matter what price you need to pay, everyone needs to be equal. And I'm not going to reread this entire paragraph, but remember just a few of these things, for example, that he said. And if we want to be democratic, if we want to be equal, then we have to, you know, manifest a tender regard for the weak, the ignorant, the unfortunate. Place the heavier and more onerous social burden on the backs of the strong. Glory in the triumphs of men. And then really down to the end, one of the things that really stood out to me is to go after and view as inimical any institution that would fight against that. And that's really kind of where this all started, beginning to see, you know, you think, why are we where we are today? Why is there such a hatred for values? Why is there such a love for things that are really against the Bible? And it began with this mindset change. We're going to look at several things today that talk about how this came through and how we see it manifested today. But here again, a new definition of democracy that we talked about last time. Real quick, he then went into social construction that he advocated. We talked about this last time that, you know, capitalism failed. He's coming out of he's in the Great Depression this time period. So capitalism has done a great disservice to America. We need a brand new system. And of course, he was a very communistically minded person. And however, he was not accepted right off the bat. We discussed that because he was viewed as like a radical. I mean, you know, back in the 30s, people weren't ready really in America to accept communism. You know, we're coming out of the Great War. World War II is on the horizon. They're not really looking to accept communism. So they looked at Counts like he was a psychopath, and they said, we don't want anything to do with this. And so what he did was he said, well, what we're going to do, instead, since America isn't ready for it, we're just going to do it secretly. And we're going to do things to where the American public doesn't know what hit them. And so he began to work quietly through the Teachers College in Columbia. He began to work through the different journals that he wrote. A new journal that he wrote was called The Social Frontier. And he sent this to all the teachers throughout the country. The professors, they were reading this stuff. And so, again, as we said, and I'm going to, by the way, show you some other things today from a really excellent book written in 1999. And I like this book because one of the things that he does is he shows how George Count's philosophy got into the textbooks to destroy the foundations of America. People say, oh, whatever, you're a conspiracy theorist. We're going to show you some things, and I hope that you understand what's happened in the last 100 years in this country. He knew that parents would be like, oh, we can't have this. We don't believe this stuff. So he went quietly, go to the children, go quietly, do some things in the textbook. And matter of fact, some things we're going to look at, they wrote some things in the textbooks that sounded pretty good so that the parents wouldn't be startled. And then in the teacher's additions to those books, it tells them, even though we said this so the parents aren't upset, make sure you teach this. It was a very on-purpose movement that was done. So he went to the teacher's college. He taught there for years, the Social Frontiers. We went over this last week. He actually tried to run for office. Fortunately, he didn't do very well in that. And then he wrote some other books down into the 50s and things like that. Now, I wanted to look at, as we started last time, how can we see this quiet revolution beginning to take change in our country? We're going to look at some of the things that he proposed and then how we see them being evidenced today. I'm going to go through this kind of quickly. So first of all, again, he said, we've got to combat all forces that produce social distinctions and classes. We've got to get rid of social distinctions. We've got to get rid of classes. And so what do we see today? We see a big emphasis on things about discrimination. We see, you know, and that is a variety of things, not just racial. You know, you see, you talk about the discrimination, people view it as, you know, sexual discrimination, sexual harassment, homosexuality. We can't be anything against those things whatsoever. This is a big deal to our society today. You know, these corporations spend all their time writing these things to protect themselves. We can't discriminate no matter what. And everybody's got to have a discrimination statement, because the worst thing you can do in this country is not murder somebody. The worst thing you can do is not, you know, go out and destroy somebody's property. The worst thing you can do is discriminate against somebody or hurt their feelings. That's the worst thing you can do. And there's price to be paid for it in our country today. Equal opportunity for everybody. Again, I don't care what someone is. If I was working in a corporation and if they could do the job, they should be hired. If they're the best person for the job, but we don't do that anymore. You know, think about it. You may not know this, but in the NFL, owners are required to interview X number of minority races for their head coaching positions. Whether they want to hire that person or not, they're required to interview a specific percentage. And so then they just go through the motions. Yeah, whatever. Okay, we interviewed all these. We're done. This is what this is all about. Equal opportunity for everybody. You know, you ever hear that, you are successful in life because you had better opportunity when you were younger. You hear that a lot today, don't you? So we've got to make everybody start out on the same plateau. So they go and spend millions and billions of dollars building these massive complexes for people to move into for free housing, or they give them all this stuff to try to close that gap. But, and we've said this before, in America and in the country God's given us, if you work hard, you can overcome those things. You can overcome them. That's the beauty of it. But we don't want to work. We want to just be given things. We want to be given things. That's the way our society works. And we see a lot of things today, especially with, you know, racial type wars and a lot of division in our country, because we're worried about we cannot have social distinctions and social classes. But the problem is we're going about it through a humanistic way. And when you do it humanistically, the result is more division. Of course, a spiritual method is not even on the radar of these people. Here's another one. What about placing the heavier and more onerous social burden on the backs of the strong? We dealt with this last week. This is directly, it sounds like we're reading a tax code from today. It's directly from his book in 1933. He said this, that the stronger have to do what? Remember? Pay their fair share. Well, who determines what's fair? Well, they're not happy until that person that has been successful is completely destroyed, so that someone who doesn't have an opportunity can then move up and take that. So, you know, an income-based tax code, all these things. Again, the strong can handle it. Let them take it. And what does that do? That encourages people to not even try. That encourages people to not even want to do the job. What if in an academic setting we said, all right, you know, it's not fair that certain people keep making A's and these others over here make F's. So what we're going to do, this is Isaac in school, right? What we're going to do is we're going to take, you know, 10 points from every student that made an A, and we're going to give it to those that made D's and F's. Well, then what do you think the people that made A's are going to do? They're like, what's the point? Why don't I just make an F? And so I can get points from somebody else. Why should I be the one? So it changes that, and so then they don't even work. But that's what they want. Because when there's no opportunity, then all of a sudden the government's going to step in. It's the pathway to socialism. But here's another one. Manifest a tender regard for the weak, the ignorant, and the unfortunate. There's nothing wrong with that. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, here in a second. We want to have a tender regard for them, but how are you going to go about doing that? Well, they were like, well, we've got to then, again, take from the rich, give to the poor. We've got this welfare. We've got the unemployment programs. We've got all this redistribution of wealth that we're doing. And I mentioned this a few weeks ago. The responsibility of helping the poor, the responsibility of helping those that are in need, lies with each of us. The Bible mentions that the nation of Israel was, God was very upset if they oppressed the poor. Read through the Old Testament. How many times in the book of Psalms the poor are mentioned, that they need to be taken care of? It's in a way, it's the church's job. It's our job. It's when you see your neighbor in need to help them. But again, the government, and we're not against helping people, but the government says it's our job to help people. And then they pick and choose what they want to do to help people, and it decentivizes everything. Here's another one. Glory in every triumph of man, he's right from his book, to make the world more habitable. So if we can continue to promote what man does, we can make the environment a better place. We can make man succeed for longer. You hear all this stuff we talked about, this, the climate change, right? The climate change, which, remember, it used to be called global warming. That scared people. So, and as I said last week or the week before, I tell the students at school that there is such a thing as global warming. And they're like, well, not from the scientific standpoint, actually, because the Bible says so, that the elements are going to melt with fervent heat. And God is going to bring a global warming when He purges this earth. But it's under His timetable. It's in His responsibility of doing things the way He does things. Actually, if you look back at, there's been studies done on it. If you look back at the past, I don't know how many hundred and something years that they've charted the percentage or the temperature change, it's very minimal. It's just patterns. It's very minimal. Down, up, down, up, down, up. But man sees that as an opportunity to have power and control. And so they take it. Here's another one. Transform or destroy all conventions, institutions, and special groups inimical to the underlying principles of democracy. Now again, what's democracy? The democratic government? Democracy is moral equality of all men. That's what. So anybody that stands against this was written in 1933, almost 100 years ago. Destroy those conventions that are not having the best interest of everybody else, you know, and they intimidate you with these little phrases, and you're not being patriotic, and on and on and on, and it's just like, wow, people, are we really going here? It's an intimidation, and we're going to destroy you. You don't agree. You want to, for example, I mean, you look at, I never thought I'd see the day, ever, but you look at what's happening with these churches that can't even meet or won't meet, or those that do meet and are paying hefty fines. Well, how dare they go against what the majority thinks they ought to do? You know, the mass of people think they shouldn't do this. They're being inimical to equality. Let's find them. Let's go after them. And now they're going to cut off their power. They're going to cut off their water, all these things that they're doing. And those churches that I never thought I'd see that in America, but we're seeing it. So we see all these things, the hate crimes, the fake news, the cancel culture, the anarchy. They're going after things that don't agree. But I thought we were supposed to be tolerant. I thought there was supposed to be equality for everybody, where everybody's views could be expressed openly without fear. Well, everybody's views except those that disagree. And we've been over that many, many times. So we see all these things happening in our country today. Now, what about educationally? Well, again, in traditional education, or what we would view as the right way to educate, a passive transmitter of culture versus modern education, leading agency of societal reform. So, I mean, passively transmitting culture, which means as you teach, of course, the young people learn about culture and they learn about those things. But now they're telling the teacher, you've got to, remember, reach for power, that word that he used, and be the leading agency of societal reform, that you can change society by changing the minds of these young people. Well, how are you going to do it? Instead of doing the three R's, you're going to teach things through like the social sciences. You know, there's used to not be a field of study called social science. Let me read some of these things here. Social science are things like anthropology, economics, sociology, political science, psychology. Those aren't necessarily bad fields of things to study, but because the focus on those things, the focus on those fields changes from, instead of being centered on traditional disciplines, now it's on social sciences, where what those subjects do, and here's what, for example, one man named Knight quotes what they do. These subjects better identify major problems of controversy and conflict and inconsistency. So if you can use these subjects, anthropology or, you know, the controversy where you see what's really wrong with society, then you can cause these young people to want to go out and make change and point out the inconsistencies and point out the problems that they're seeing. So don't worry about the three R's. Just focus on social issues. Another one. What about state responsibility in education? You know, we dealt with that several months ago when we dealt with the history of public education, where the states were the ones, the homes and the churches and the states were the ones running it. But now, because the federal government offers this little 10% of the entire budget of the state education, then they just kowtow down and take whatever they want. So here's the things. Federal involvement now is a huge thing. They're pouring, you know, it's the one of the largest budgets in the government is education. And look at the results we're getting. We're plummeting in the world statistics in math and science and reading. You know, it's unbelievable that you have to have, you know, high-end colleges that have a remedial class just to learn how to read. Why? Because they're not learning how to read. Well, I thought they were, because we're pouring millions and billions of dollars into education. They should be able to read. And so we see this focus on, instead of student achievement and the student learning, it's egalitarianism, where we all learn together. Everybody is going to be on the same page. That's kind of the premise of Common Core that was popular about 7-8 years ago. So all of these things happening, wanting to change the way education happens. Now, here's one of the last things that he wrote about in one of his final books that he wrote late at the end of his life, 1976. He wrote a foreword to a book, and he said, "Let us proceed, therefore, to rear a generation of mavericks, a generation capable of grappling boldly, intelligently, and creatively with our swiftly changing world." So we've got, you know, what's the idea of a maverick? A rebel. Remember the old maverick, the cow? I like that story. The kids like it too. You know, a rebel, basically. In other words, we need a generation not of people that just accept the traditional values and move forward, but a people that look back and say, "I don't like that. We've got to change that," because we can't progress unless every generation changes everything. So let's boldly go up and do those things. Now, I wanted to share a few other thoughts this morning, and it's from, as I said, a book that I've read several years ago. It's an excellent book. It's a man named John Stormer. He was actually a pastor, and he did a lot of research study. He was involved with the Missouri Association of Christian Schools back in the day, I think 70s and 80s, and he did a lot of research on what was going on in the textbooks, even then in the 70s and 80s and in recent time. And of course, that, you know, seems a long way off to me, to most of us, because we're in 2020. This is, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But he wrote this about 20 years ago. About 20 years ago, he wrote the compilation of some things that he found in public education, things that he found that was going on in the textbooks that parents had no idea. And if you want to ever read a book that makes your blood boil, it's this one. I've never been more upset in my life. I can't believe it's eye-shocking, the things that are going on in public education. And parents, that's the whole idea. They don't want the parents to know about these things. And so one of the things that he wrote about and talked about here in this big section of his book in the middle, first of all, he compares how readers used to be years ago versus how they are now. For example, he talked about the McGuffey readers. Maybe you remember the McGuffey readers. They were the standard for American education for years. But he says, "The world of the McGuffeys was a world where no one questioned the truths of the Bible or their relevance to everyday conduct." No one questioned. They assumed that the Bible principles were true throughout those things. Now, they said that instead of that, though, we have to, you know, children today are better taught than were their luckless predecessors, is generally conceded, though we are sometimes puzzled that we have not produced a generation of statesmen as distinguished as the founding fathers. Why are we not producing generations of statesmen? Because he's saying, here the liberals are like, "Why? We're teaching them way better, but they're turning out to be morally evil," because we've thrown out the moral principles. And that's the point he's making. You can't compare the textbooks of the older time that assumed morality. They assumed biblical principles. And now all of a sudden, oh, we're just throwing these things out. And this book brings out 12 points. I'm going to try to cover as many of them as I can quickly. He calls them 12 pillars of this educational system of America, if education is to succeed, if this country is to succeed, what things are being knocked down to allow this modern education to happen? Or what did really the textbooks do? And he relates this to examples from textbooks that they went after every one of these 12 items to completely destroy them. And this, again, was 20 years ago. Knock these 12 pillars down and we can have our new social order. We can have our new society, and I dare say we're watching it play out in front of our eyes today, these things. Let's look at the 12 pillars that the textbooks of public education have gone after. The first one is marriage, family, and home. Marriage, family, and home. It says, for over 30 years, textbooks and other curriculum have exhibited anti-family bias. Anti-family bias. One of the things they say is that divorce is acceptable. In the textbooks, divorce is acceptable. So here's some examples of some of the books. This is, again, a 6th through 8th grade curriculum called Homemaking Skills for Everyday Living that they taught to 6th through 8th grade girls. Other people have this till love do us part attitude toward marriage. They see marriage as a short-term goal. They seem to expect that someday their love will come to an end. They plan to end their marriage at that time, and divorce is considered an acceptable way of solving the problem. Now, that was a book that was written to 6th through 8th girls. Here's another one that they had to memorize a poem. Again, they're going to undermine the family. I always hope father is going to play with the paper in front of his face that way. I think he might look from the edge and wink or peekaboo me, but what do you think? He reads all the pages from A to Z and never once thinks of being daddy to me. Now, that may be true that a father may be like that, but the point is they're teaching this attitude to kids to always look negatively at your father. He's out to get me. He doesn't want to care for me. And so they continue to do things. Now, here's a really good one. In the late 1960s, words in color. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole issue of the whole language and all that stuff, but that's learning habit or learning patterns of reading, the dog is fat. And if you learn that, then you can say the cat is fat. And you can say the person is fat, whatever. You just keep repeating the same things as you learn to read and recognize the word fat, for example. And I say that after Thanksgiving, but we're definitely getting there. So in order to help students learn to read, words with different vowel sounds were printed in different colors. So they look for the same color, and that's the same vowel sound. So an Ohio mother became concerned when halfway through the sermon in church, she saw that her first grade daughter was writing, Sam is a filthy rat. Mom is a filthy rat. Dad is a filthy rat. A picture was drawn on the paper of a woman's body with a rat's head, and it was labeled Mom. Horrified, the mother asked Brenda, where did you learn anything like that? Little first grade girl replied, in school, Mama. The mother visited the school and found a number of papers Brenda had written which said, Sam is a nut, Tim is a nut, Tom is a nut, Pam is a nut. Okay, in other words, we're repeating to learn how to read the word nut. And then it said, Tim is filthy, Mom is filthy, Daddy is filthy, Mom is a pest, Dad is a pest, so forth, so forth, so forth. And on the papers, the teacher had written good. Because the teacher was worried about what did you do to learn the word instead of thinking about what she was actually saying. The child is instructed. So the first grade words like Mom, Pop, Filthy, Pest, Rat, Dad, Sam, Tim, and Is. And the child is instructed to make sentences using words you now know. Again, that goes back to regret. Let them do what they want. And so it doesn't matter what they say. They could have written something filthy. They could have written something terrible about somebody. They can demean their parents. That doesn't matter. And it's promoted and applauded because we're learning to read this particular way. So many different examples I could look at. Here's another one. The generation gap that, don't worry about the family. There's a bunch of old timers in the family. Here's another Missouri school book that they said. After reading numerous brief stories about families in turmoil, students are asked to list things your family fights about most. I don't know why that's a productive school exercise. Another lesson in the same book tells students that ideas like things are bound to become outmoded and change from generation to generation. Student is then asked to list 6 old-fashioned things in his home and 6 old-fashioned ideas his parents have, so that he can be better than his parents. You know, they're outdated, them old stuff like that. And so, you know, all they write in all kinds of things. I could go over a variety of things here. They had a survey that they gave them of 52 questions. that they're supposed to respond to as just yes or no. Things like, my parents always bicker at home, right? Yes or no. Or my parents are too strict, right? Yes or no. I'm ashamed of my father's job, yes or no. My father's a tyrant. I'm ashamed of the way my parents dress. Why are we asking kids to do those things and to answer those type of questions, a 52-question treatise that they made the students do? That's what they wanted to promote. Bring the family down. The traditional family, this is our message, is no longer viable. It doesn't work. So we have to do it a different way. We have to redefine what the family is. Now, that led to another secondary, and I'm just skipping quickly. There's hundreds of examples we could look at from the textbooks. But here's another one. Not just marriage, family, and home. What about morality in marriage? Things like, and we discussed this last time, things like the fact that, you know, sexual relationships outside of marriage are wrong. That is laughed at today. You understand that? It is a mockery. It's hilarious to people that you would even think that there's another way. And young people are jeered if they're, you know, a virgin or whatever. They're jeered for that. This is what you do. This is what teenagers do. It's what high schoolers do. And they had to, where do they get that thinking? You know, most parents are probably surprised that they didn't get it from their parents. Their parents, I mean, what good parent wants their child to end up being immoral? No one wants their daughter to go do those things, a variety of people. But they learned it somewhere. They learned it somewhere. Here's some things. In America's history, for the most part, did you know there were laws against adultery, fornication, sodomy, all those things? There were laws against it. But now, not anymore. Of course, we discussed how that changes in the entertainment system of our country. I remember I told you back in the 90s, it was not a big deal. It was a big deal. Let me rephrase that. They made it be not a big deal by the sitcoms and all those things that they did. At first, it was like, oh my goodness, those people in that sitcom are living together. Well, that quickly desensitized people. And then it was like, oh my goodness, in the early 2000s, there's a sodomite in that film. Wow. And that desensitizes. And now all of that is normal. I'm scared of what's coming next. I don't know what else form of debauchery they can go to. But they've desensitized and made it normal. Here's some things that were written in some high school textbooks, okay? I'm not going to read all the things, but here's at least five examples of what textbooks have been exposing young people to since the 1970s. I'm just going to read some of the general things. This is a 9th and 10th grade book. Adolescent petting, okay, is an important opportunity to learn about sexual responses and to gratify sexual and emotional desires without a more serious commitment. That was given to 9th and 10th graders in 1980. Listen to this one. This one is just made my head spin. 1979, grades 6 through 12. I'm not reading all the details, this is inappropriate, but rarely is any harm done to the child by child molesters and exhibitionists. That was written I'm not going to read the rest of it. It's horrible. The teacher's guide for that book instructs the teacher to have the students write a one-sentence statement on why sexual relationships can be fun for an adolescent. Now, do you think most of the parents know that stuff's going on in the school? I don't think so. Here's another one, 1981. Delbert and Sally are living together while they're in college. They do not expect to marry. They feel that living together provides each other with love, affection, and support. This is why, by the end of the 1990s, living together outside of marriage was no big deal. Because that generation was taught that it isn't a big deal. What is a big deal? Just love each other. You just have to love each other. And if you love each other, you support each other. The rest of it doesn't matter. Don't worry about these traditional values. This is another one, grades 7 through 12, 1976. The place, the opportunity, and their bodies all say, go. How far this couple goes must be their decision. Because right and wrong don't matter. You decide. You decide how far you want to go. Another one. This is 1971. Everyone must develop his own set of principles to govern his own sexual behavior. Teaching these kids since the 70s that there's not a right and wrong with it. It's only, what do you want? What is right to you in this situation? And so they're totally destroying the pillar of morality in marriage. There are so many other things that could go here. How they had sex education brought into the public schools, and they wrote things for ages 5 through 8, then 9 through 12, 12 through 15. I'm not going to go into it, but it is shocking the things that age 5 through 8 was reading and going over as part of this program. And they just integrated with the public schools and just brought it in as part of their health curriculum. 1994, the U.S. Center for Disease Control made a 5-year agreement to promote comprehensive sexuality and AIDS education in America's schools. So how did they promote it? We're trying to protect the young people from bad diseases. Well, there's an easy way to teach them how to be protected from that. But that's God's way. That doesn't make any sense. We can't do that. So we're going to come up with some other stuff, while also telling them it's okay to do whatever they think and what they want. Destroying the morals of these things. Questions that they asked, I mean, it's unbelievable some of the things that they have brought in here. Another one, quickly, we're running out of time. The sanctity of life. Of course, first of all, you think about abortion and how that was promoted. Still is today. Of course, the court decisions that overturned or that caused it to be even allowed in our country. Think of the millions and millions of lives that have been lost over the past 40, 50 years because of that decision. But the same, in other words, I'm telling you, a nation that devalues a life, it's not going to last. It is not lasting. That's one of the most fundamental things that we have is life. And God has serious consequences and laws about taking life. But it's devalued. But not just in abortion, but what about death education? I don't know if you've ever done much research about that, but that is actually a big movement and has been for about 20 or 30 years in public schools. I've read several articles about it and done some research on it where dying is promoted. It's a way out because life doesn't matter. Who cares? Your life is just in bondage. So they talk about death education in health books, the experience of dying. Here's a poem, a 10th grade literature poem. Here it is. Razors pain you, rivers are damp, acids stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give. Gas smells awful, you might as well live. Yeah, you might as well live. Suicide is a bit grim. Now, all of those are ways you could commit suicide that are kind of tough. And it ends with this. Now if only I could think of a better way. Not a better way to not commit suicide, a better way to commit suicide. Here's one. During the 1992 and 93 school year, 6th and 7th grade students. Now I want you to think about that. That's 11 and 12 year olds. They were shown a video entitled Carl. Sequences in the film showed a boy being teased and praying to God for help. Then they played Amazing Grace as the video showed the silhouette of the boy's body hanging in the room. Now they're watching this. And the funeral message was this. We're here to celebrate the death of Carl. We usually celebrate the life of someone, but for he is now experiencing happiness that eluded him in life. From this day on, he will find a better life. But they don't. They don't know that. They're just telling the kids, this is your way out. Because they don't believe in God. They don't believe in an app. They don't believe in that stuff. Just get out. Just be done with it. And I mean, the statistics that are in this book are a little bit older. In 1962, before school started death education, 550 teenagers had killed themselves. By 1987, teen suicides went from 550 a year to 6,000 a year. Just in the brief, 7 to 8 years of this death education type of mentality. This is the direction that these textbooks are going. We've got 12 pillars. I don't know if I'm ever going to have time to get back to this. I'm going to quickly go through them. The sanctity of private property. They want globalism. They don't want you to own your own property. If you don't work, you don't eat. That's in there. Why should you work? Right and wrong are absolutes. Got to get rid of that one. We got to get rid of the sanctity of contracts. Your word means something. Mr. Whitney and I talk about this. It used to be that people's word meant something. You used to not have to sign on a piece of paper. Yes, sir. And you did it because your word meant something. Not anymore. You got to have contract, 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 contract. I'm not against contracts, but you have to have them. Because, why? Because people don't keep their word. We don't care. We say we'll do whatever we want. There's no value of integrity anymore. We don't have time for that. Protecting national sovereignty. We don't want to be a unique nation anymore. You've got to be a part of the global platform. The fact that individual rights come from God. Delegated authority. The certainty of answering to God. They don't destroy that. You don't answer to anybody. And then God's existence. They got to get rid of all of these things to promote what they wanted to do. And it all started in the 1930s with these frontier thinkers. And people looked at them like, you guys are crazy. And they said, yep, we are. So they went quietly back to their little ivory towers and pumped it out. Textbooks, there's money all in this. There's tons. Follow the money. It's ridiculous. How do these publishers, these textbooks they print for public schools, they print them, they're $200 a piece. As soon as they're done with them that year, you get them on eBay for $3. Why? Because the government is going to pay for a whole new set of them. It's all money. Well, who's driving that? Somebody that's a lobbyist that got in there and wants their voice heard. And then they get all this dirty stuff and they get blackmail on this person and that person. Nobody's afraid to do anything. And it's so much corruption. But really, it's moving toward the end of things. You know, the Lord still knows what He's doing. He's in control. I grieve when I see these things being destroyed in our country. It's sad. It is very sad. But this is what a nation without God wants, sadly. And so we've got to do right. We've just got to keep on doing right. As long as God leaves us here to do that, we're going to do right. And that's a decision we can make in our homes, we can make in our lives, we can make in our places of influence, our ministries, and we can serve the Lord and do right even in the midst of these things. Father, thank you for the time this morning and for those that have gathered here. Continue to watch over us and help us to serve you faithfully. It's not, Lord, be disheartened at what's going on, but to be emboldened to continue to do your work in your way. Bless our service this morning in Christ's name. Amen.